Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Good evening and welcome to the John Whitmer Show, sponsored by Wink Hartman and the Hartman Group of Companies. My name is Jim Howell, Sedgwick County Commissioner, filling in for John Whitmer this evening. We're happy to have you join us tonight here at your local Liberal Resistance headquarters, where we proudly champion the conservative principles of limited government, individual liberty, free enterprise, and traditional values. We are pleased to have you here with us this evening. If you'd like to call into our studio lines, they're open. You can reach us at 316-869-1330 or by email at john@knssradio.com or on Facebook, The John Whitmer Show, and on X at John R. Whitmer. Please reach out. We'd love to hear from you. We have a great show planned for you this evening. Coming up later tonight, we will explore why Democrats are trying to tie RFK Jr. to Trump in a desperate bid to shore up support for Joe Biden with Tony Lyons, who is the co-founder of American Values 2024, the RFK Jr. Super PAC. Then Marcy Lafine will be with us to explain how President Biden's 30 by 30 executive order calls for the conservation of 30% of U.S. lands and waters by 2030, and how that could impact landowners in Kansas. We have legal expert Hans von Spakovsky. It's hard to say this one. Hans von Spakovsky. I'll get better at that one, I think. But he'll join us this evening to discuss the hush money. Trump trial in New York, conservative author Cheryl Chumley will be with us to discuss why she says America's college and anti-Semitism is the Democrat Party's shame. Caroline Moore, the vice president of Parents Defending Education, will join us to explain why their organization claims that the Biden administration's final Title IX regulations announced this week, incorporating gender identity into Title IX, have major implications for privacy and safety and effectively erases single-sex spaces that ensure the security of female students. We'll get to our weekly Under the Dome legislative update from Kansas House Speaker Pro Tem Blake Carpenter, and we'll be taking your calls later on this evening at 316-869-1330. So it's great to be with you this evening. This is a great honor to host this show tonight. I am a huge fan, a religious listener of the John Whitmer Show. And so to be on this side of the microphone is quite thrilling for me. If you know much about me, you might say I'm a bit of an odd duck. I ask a lot of questions and seem to have a lot of passion for a lot of policy issues. I pride myself to be analytical, and it's a gift and a curse. Some people might disagree, but, well, for me, I tend to be suspicious and distrusting of someone else's narrative. I like to chase the conclusions back to the data source and that delivered them. Whether it's a discussion on salary proposals or electrical regulations, I am going to research until I can determine the truth. So back in 2020, county commissioners discovered that they had the legal responsibility to determine the policies that would govern our community's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. I vividly remember 2 points. On a Sunday afternoon, a special BOCC meeting on March 22, 2020, Dr. Mintz, who is the county health officer, he encouraged the county to establish significant restrictions on the sovereign citizens of Sedgwick County. At that moment, we had zero cases of COVID in Sedgwick County. The so-called experts said if we did nothing, we could see as many as 50,000 deaths, or 10% of Sedgwick County's residents. They said to stop this, we needed to implement these restrictions for 2 weeks. At this point, it seemed to me this was an alarmist rhetoric, and the solution sounded even more silly. It was a few days earlier, on March 18th, Governor Laura Kelly made an executive decision to close all public schools, when across the state we only had one case of COVID. Looking back now, doesn't this seem ridiculous? I remember raising constitutional concerns. I was reminded quickly that I was no expert and that I should do the right thing to protect the public. I boldly stated that I believed that the best attack would be to educate the public and to trust them to make the best health decisions for themselves and their families. I was outvoted, as usual, and so the liberal faction on the commission that led that day, I continued to fight against the government control. Ultimately, the commission allowed liquor stores and abortion clinics to operate while they closed down churches. I remember digging into the data nearly every single day. I constantly made arguments for a strategy that would respect the sovereign citizens to determine their own response to COVID. Some of you may be listening to me right now, and perhaps you are one that had immune-compromised health, and you could not leave your basement for a year or more. On one side, I feel your plight and your situation. But on the other side, I entrust the principles of self-determination. I firmly believe that government is not here to control us, but to serve us. These mandates and restrictions put the safety of one person on the back of another. The Republican principle of personal responsibility and personal freedom were destroyed with these useless government rules. I stated that anyone that needed to have greater protection could always do more for themselves, accepting greater responsibility. Principles and data should always drive our decisions. I know I have some opponents that do not like the fact that I am data-driven when it comes to election integrity and security. I have studied this topic for many, many years, and I'm engaged in the debate. Yet when I present conclusions based on data that go against the popular opinion, I make a lot of people angry. I can talk taxes at a deep level. I think I know more about tax policy than many of my peers, and I'm glad the state is working on some overdue tax cuts. I sure hope that passes this weekend, or should I say Monday or Tuesday. And the data certainly supports a strong argument that this really must happen this session. I'm a cheerleader on the state doing this, and they cannot do it soon enough, in my opinion. Actually, I have a few mind-blowing ideas that I cannot get any support for because I'm not in the legislature. One example is how about a property tax credit applied to every property right now, this year, to lower the burden right now. The great people of our state have overpaid the state, and they should return it as soon as possible, and they should do it in a way that would address the most despised tax of all, which is namely property tax. Just this week, I was reviewing a proposed national electric code proposal, and the subject of whole house surge protection devices was proposed as a new mandate for newly remodeled homes or new construction. I see this as a smart consumer decision, but it should not be mandated in building codes. It will not save a human life, but it could be that it would save a TV or consumer electronics. It's like consumer insurance. So why are we contemplating this? Well, because the NEC says so. It could be that it would add hundreds of dollars to the cost of a home while we are struggling to have enough affordable housing. This is exactly the wrong type of regulation that we need. Understanding how this works and studying the data has led me to a conservative conclusion that we should not mandate SPDs in homes. But to return to my main point, we need to be data-driven. So much of this country is divided right now, and one of the problems we are having is echo-chambered country. We are anecdotal. So much of the debate is shallow and based on very little data. I think we can do better, but it takes time and energy to dig into the data and ask great questions. One of the frustrations I see getting worse and worse, both nationally and within the state of Kansas, and even locally, is our political divide. Even within the Republican Party, we are seeing a split and a loss of guiding principles. If we cannot unify over our principles and on basic platform language that should guide us in our policy, we will lose here and there and everywhere. There's too much at stake. We need to agree on principles. We need to be open to our minds, be inquisitive and data-driven. We need to be willing to concede our assumptions and accept reality, whether it's about election security, tax policy, surge protection devices, or COVID. We need to know our principles and stick to the Constitution and let verifiable data drive our decision-making. Back in 2021, President Joe Biden directed the Department of the Interior to develop a plan to conserve at least 30% of our lands and waters by 2030. In collaboration with the Departments of Agriculture and Commerce, many have argued that President's true intention is to undermine private property rights, restrict landowners' ability to control their own lands, and prioritize environmental, non-governmental organizations over hardworking American producers of energy and agricultural commodities. So joining us now to discuss these details of the and implications of Biden's 30 by 30 agenda is Marcy Lafine. Marcy, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be here. Always glad to be a part of this conversation.
Well, I remember years ago talking about Agenda 21, and I guess this is the next level. So
yep.
I'd like you to fill us in. I'm not as familiar with this one, but I think we need to get familiar because this is, as we just talked a little bit before the show here, this is terrifying, frankly. So, Marcy, preserving America the beautiful is great on paper, but the devil's in the details. In Biden's 30 by 30 conservation plan, please explain what this is. What prompted the adoption of this plan? And tell us about it, Marcy.
So you kind of have to go back further. Like you mentioned, the Agenda 21. Unfortunately, George H.W. Bush had done some things with that. It was non-binding. The Senate did not ratify it back when he was president. Under Obama, he proceeded to join the Paris Climate Agreement. And Trump pulled us out, thank God. None of this has been ratified by the Senate. You know, our Constitution it would be kind of handy at this point in time. But then Biden proceeded to have executive orders, and their executives 14008, 13990, and I think one called 14072. He's got multiple executive orders, which he claims can just build on the Clean Water Act, which, again, back to history, Nixon put it that in with the EPA. This stuff goes way back. Clinton put in sustainability language throughout our government. So there's building blocks that have been put in place, and now we're at a place where they're just undoing the language. They're redefining. You know, it's a Marxist tactic, right? So what we think sustainability means is not what we think it really is, or conservation. For them, you know, farmers go, yeah, I'm all about conservation because they have to preserve the land for their family, for the generations to come. But this means no humans, no livestock on it. They really want no people to be productive on the land.
Yeah, that brings up a lot of questions for me. You know, again, conservation on its own is not a bad idea. But when government pushes the idea out there and takes our right to make decisions away, it's very concerning. And you know, I remember the Agenda 21, a way I would summarize it is that basically the policy was that they viewed humans as the problem.
Yes.
I just find that very troubling.
Well, yeah. And they honestly, this is that depopulation mentality. Yeah. But they look at cattle as a problem, which is such a joke, because if you look at them as being a cud-chewing animal, well, so are deer. And I think are elk. You know, so if you look worldwide, there's just as many of those ruminary animals as there are cows. But yeah, we're going to target the food supply item that we all enjoy. It's so suspicious. And if they really cared about water, they would, you know, like today I was reading on their latest thing, their climate core and the different places where they're trying to put in Justice 40, and they're always about diversity and inclusion. So this isn't just about 30 by 30. It's changing our whole climate of our culture, and they're bringing in ESG, DEI with everything they're doing and where they're implementing it. But they threw out $12 million to Kansas City to create a canopy, you know, the new trees. $12 million. I mean, where's that money going to go?
So Agenda 21 seems like it was policy driven, you know, trying to reduce the impact of humans on the planet, so to speak, right? And discouraging air conditioning and automobiles and yep. pushing forward bicycles and things like that. This one seems like there's another component basically a land grab and water grab. So some argue that this is nothing more than a federal land grab. Are they right?
Yes. And it's already been happening. 50% of the West is controlled by the feds. 97% of Nevada is controlled by the feds. Just see how they've done it through the years, and it's through regulation. They've driven off the ranchers. They've driven off the farmers, so they no longer can be sustaining a ranching or farming job, and so they leave the land, and it's taken. The other area is national heritage areas. It's mm-hmm. scenic byways. They call something called viewshed. There's nature conservancies, which are for perpetuity. I mean, forever. And they sadly, we have a very aging population in our farmer realm. And so they don't have kids coming back to the farm. Well, people come in and go, we'll help you protect your land, but they're not being honest about what's being in those conservation things that lock it up forever.
And so I guess it leads me to a question. So how do they plan about how can they possibly take someone's land And is it even legal? How do they do that?
So again, the conservation easements are one where the people sign and they don't realize that they've become serfs on their own land. Somebody else is managing it. They have no say anymore. Again, the language is not what one person thinks it's one thing, whereas the feds mean something entirely. And again, it's the regulation that people can no longer survive. But it's not just the land. It's about the food. And we are seeing the one thing recently is the EPA came out with new regulations about our meat lockers. I just talked to my butcher in Whitewater saying, hey, is this affecting you? And he said, no, the cutoff is 6,000 pounds of butchering per day. Well, a steer can be 1,200 to 1,500 pounds. That's only four steer a day that you're butchering. Before they were going to have to put in a water treatment system before their wastewater would reach the sewer. So we're facing losing another segment of our meat butchers, which, you know, COVID, that was a real deal, right? And we're facing losing them. So back to the 30 by 30, the fact that President Biden, these executive orders, has mandated that they put these in at lightning pace, because, of course, they call it a climate crisis, right? It's an emergency. We got to do it right now. That they're coming into every single agency and they're cutting corners on public comment periods. They're cutting the time. They're not having second rounds. It is so deceptive. And there's been, praise God, Attorney General Kobach has been joined many states on many lawsuits on these things because they keep trying to put it in.
He's been great for the landowner. He understands the Constitution and the threats of our government, frankly. We're listening to Marcy Lafine. She's talking about the Biden's 30 by 30 agenda. So, Marcy, will Congress have to pass any legislation to enact any of this, or can Biden and his administration just put out this plan by an executive order?
It's happening.
It's happening right now.
It's happening every single day. We get new reports every single day of how this is happening.
It's just terrifying to me.
It's alarming.
Yeah.
No farmers, no food. Have you seen that movie, the documentary by Epic Times? We're living it.
Wow.
And all you have to do is look to Europe. They're 20 years ahead of us, and you're seeing them telling them the farmers have to cull their cattle. They're having to give up their land. But again, in the language, you know, we were talking before we went on air, they're even your education department, right, is putting this down. And so you got kids in schools watching Before the Flood, which is a radical movie about climate science. We're gonna die and you got to stop eating meat and you got to do your part because it's this doomsday thing that's not based on truth.
Well, it seems like a lot of this is just totally junk science to me.
It's
just horrible that and this is driving policy. It really is. It is alarming, frankly. You know, I think back about Agenda 21. I guess their goal was to do all these things by 2021.
Yes.
They obviously failed,
right?
Which is why I guess we're on round two of this, but it's actually worse.
So they have 17 goals, the UN Agenda 2030, if you look at them, and it's very comprehensive.
Okay.
It's every arena of life except religion, because it is a religion.
Hmm.
And so they're looking to implement this in every facet of our life and have it be earth worship or subordination. I mean, this is about ESG scores, environment, social governance. And they're we didn't get into the natural asset accounts yet, but Biden has mandated every agency do a natural asset accounting. So they're trying to put a monetary value to photosynthesis, pollination, clean air, clean water. Well, what a perfect way to offset your $35 trillion spending habit is to come up with this fictitious government-generated valuation of everything. But then, honestly, it's going to put the feds against your private landowners because they're the largest landowner.
So it leads me to a really, I guess, a thought here. What can anybody do about this, and where can they go to get more information about it?
So, American Stewards of Liberty is a phenomenal resource. I have found them to be very reliable with the latest information. I would say if you're in Kansas, if you're a county commissioner, join the Kansas Natural Resource Coalition. They are front and ahead of the game because they've been helping Western Kansans deal with the federal government with this lesser prairie chicken, with the Quivira water issues. They have been learning the coordination technique, which our federal agencies actually have that language within them. And most county commissioners do not realize that they actually have the power to call a meeting that the feds would have to come sit down and they would get to set the agenda. Now, one county mistakenly did that. They were just trying to have a meeting and they didn't realize what they were doing was calling coordination. And if you call that and you're not ready, the nine big wig attorneys from the East Coast show up and you're sitting playing hardball with some big guys.
Well, when as a county commissioner here in Sedgwick County, when Richard Ranzau was here, he did lead us to join KNRC, yeah. and we actually did that. Carl, Peter, John, and I
yep.
supported
Carl
that.
Told me that.
Yeah, we did that. So I was very proud of the fact that we were part of the KNRC. I think, unfortunately, the following election in 2016, we lost the majority, and the county basically thought this was not important. I think it's incredibly important.
It's incredibly important, and yeah. I think, and I when I spoke at the Pachyderm a couple weeks ago, I was like, your food, do you like to eat your food? Because this is getting real yeah. when they're coming in and dictating conservation.
Well, Marcy, thank you so much for taking time to help us understand this more deeply. We really appreciate your expertise. You're fantastic.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to, or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails.
Earlier this week, White House Deputy Secretary, Press Secretary Andrew Bates issued a statement against the so-called pro-Palestinian student protests that have been churning on America's college campuses in recent months, calling the most recent displays blatantly anti-Semitic and condemning them in the strongest terms and as despicable, quote-unquote. But many argue these protesters are a product of the Democrat machine. Coming home to roost with us now to explain why she says America's college anti-Semitism is the Democrat Party's shame is conservative author Cheryl Shumley. So, Cheryl, thank you for joining us this evening.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Cheryl, extremists and the campus occupations across America are part of the same movement that brought us violence to the cities in 2020, aren't they?
Pretty much, yes. And these are all born of Democrat policies and agendas, right? Just for one example, look at how Democrats have torn apart America by race, by sex, by class, and generated all this sort of envy among the classes. And then you take that and you bring that to college campuses where the youth on college campuses have been brought up for 12 years in the public school systems to hate America and to blame America for all that ails the world. And part of that, of course, being America's allies, Israel. And it's really no surprise what we're seeing on college campuses today.
Wow. Well, I see your point, and I completely agree with you. It seems like the teachers' unions and DNC have spent so many years lowering educational standards and promoting radicals like the Democrat Socialists of America. it's no wonder these campus radicals are taking over. What do you say?
Well, if you look at what the Democratic Socialists of America have pushed for years now, go right to their website and you can check this out in their own words. They have actively sought DSA members to go into the field of public school teaching because they see it as a position that it's difficult for them to get fired from, government jobs and so forth. But B, they see it as a way of bringing forth the socialist Marxist agenda into the youngest and most innocent and vulnerable of America's minds. And so they have infiltrated the school systems. And this is the natural outcome of 10, 15, 20 years even of the dumbing down of schools, children in schools, and the infiltration of socialists, really, card-carrying socialists in teaching positions.
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, we're seeing DEI pretty much everywhere these days, especially on college campuses. So do you think that diversity, equity, and inclusion programs on college campuses are behind the recent spike in campus anti-Semitism?
Well, it certainly feeds into that narrative, right? I mean, these things don't happen in a bubble. So the whole woke generation, right, the millennials, the snowflake type of generation being brought onto college campuses with a very anti-America slant, and then they're confronted with agendas like you just brought up, DEI, that right. All feeds into this same narrative.
Well, I tell you, when I watch the newscasts and see what's going on these campuses, it's just appalling. I'm speechless, frankly. I don't know what to think about it, but it's obviously getting worse and worse, and I don't know where it's going. But so tonight we're speaking with conservative author Charles Chumley. Thank you for being with us tonight. Next question is, President Biden seems to be trying to have it both ways, trying not to upset his left-wing base by not fully condemning these protests. Is that correct, Cheryl?
Yeah, you know, think about it for a second. If these were all pro-Trump protesters on America's college campuses, first off, the administrators would find a backbone and they would have clamped down immediately on it. But in the small chance that they weren't able to do it, they certainly would have called in the police. And then if the police weren't able to do it, you would have, coming from this White House, messaging that just condemned these protesters in the harshest of terms, followed quickly by threats from the Department of Justice to launch investigations wherever they could on college campuses. So the message would have been sent loud and clear that these types of protests, if they were done by MAGA-type kids, were not allowed. So how come we're not getting that same sort of messaging from this White House when we have blatant, not just anti-Semitic protesters, but pro-Hamas, pro-terror group protesters?
Anecdotally, I would just say that the folks on the right, when they protest, they don't destroy the area around them. They don't tend to go to violence. What I see right now is intimidation and violence in these protests by the Palestinians and these students. And even members of Congress right now are actively supporting these protesters. Have you seen that as well?
Well, these members of Congress who are supporting these protesters, they're doing it with an agenda in mind. They're doing it because they're in this political bubble, so nothing that they create in terms of chaos ever impacts them. So they can afford to step forward and pretend like they're supporting First Amendment speech rights, which these don't fall under First Amendment speech rights, right? Because you're talking about Jewish students being advised by their rabbis to stay off college campuses because of safety and security concerns. That goes far beyond a First Amendment issue. But second off, most of the Democrats who are supporting these types of protests on college campuses, they bring that anti-Semitic viewpoint to Congress with them. The squad is filled with anti-Semites, right? That's basically one of their card-carrying agendas. And they've been pretty open about it, even though they have been outed time and again. So I wouldn't read too much into the Democrats on Capitol Hill supporting these protesters, except to say that no surprise here. We know what they stand for. At least now they're being open about it.
It's interesting. I've watched, of course, I'm a Sedgwick County commissioner here, one of the commissioners for Sedgwick County, one of the five. In the city of Wichita, they've had Palestinian people come out and advocate for essentially a proclamation demanding, if you will, that we would condemn the Israel's positioning on this and to support the Palestinian violence, if you will. I'm appalled by that. And we haven't seen it at the county just yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see this at even places like Sedgwick County. This seems like this debate's happening in cities and counties across this country. And I'm just shocked right now that people think that violence is the answer, and they condemn Israel for basically defending themselves. This is what started this whole thing.
Well, we're not seeing it in Texas, are we? Because they shut down the protest movement there pretty quickly. So we're seeing it mostly in the Democrat-run communities, whether they're college campuses or local governments, right? And it's the same playbook that the Black Lives Matter movement used to. They came out and they pretended that they had some sort of justified grievance that gave them the right to shut down city streets and throw bricks through storefront windows and so forth. And then shortly after, they were emboldened by the Barack Obama White House, who even invited members of Black Lives Matter to the White House to discuss things with him. As soon as they received that sort of head pat from the Democrats, they came out with their own list of demands. And this is the way of Marxists, right? They create this chaos using violence because they see that as a justifiable way to get their ends. And then they have their list of demands, which are usually so ridiculous that no sane person could even consider them.
Well, Cheryl, if folks want to connect with you or read more about your articles, can they? I think they can find you at online at CherylChumley.com. That's CherylChumley.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Me. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to say thank you so much for being with us this evening. I really appreciate your time tonight.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right.
Jim, I got to hop in here, let you know we are still trying to connect with Tony. He's apparently he's on the road. We got him, and then we dropped him, and then we got him again, and we dropped him again. So we're having some connection issues.
Well, I love having you on the show as a guest.
Oh, wow. sure. what do you want to know? I can't really talk about RFK Jr. I mean, I'm not going to vote for Robert Kennedy Jr., but the more votes he takes from Biden, I'm happy with it. But
it's interesting, it does have an impact on the race, though, does it not?
Oh, sure. I saw some polling the other day. Yeah, I mean, he takes votes from Trump, but I think what he does is he gives the never Trumpers a home. And frankly, that also hurts Biden because otherwise I think those never Trumpers would go to Biden. I think we saw that 4 years ago that, the reason I think one of the reasons Joe won is because never Trumpers voted for Joe.
Right.
And now in this cycle in November, never Trumpers, if Kennedy's not there, never Trumpers may vote for Joe again. But if there's Kennedy in there, those never Trumpers may consider. I don't think Republicans are going to, go to Kennedy, but I do think some of the hell no, I'm not voting for Trump might vote for him.
I know some of those folks.
This is our problem as Republicans. We had some who did that with Schmidt and voted for Pyle, and now we have 4 more years of Laura Kelly. And 4 years ago, or going on, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, was the same thing with Kobach, and we got Laura Kelly in the first place.
That's right.
And it's the same thing with Donald Trump. I know a few of those never Trumpers. And this election cycle, I've been very public about the fact that initially I wasn't a Trump guy. I liked Ron DeSantis. I thought DeSantis would be a great candidate. I think Glenn Youngkin would be a great president. All that being said, now Trump's the nominee, and I will 100% be, 100% behind Trump. I'm going to vote for Trump. I will, if I'm out door knocking, I'll be happy to carry his lit, put out a yard sign.
I'm a strategic voter. It doesn't really matter if I like him so much. I just know I don't want Biden personally.
Well, yeah, our guy's better than their guy. And it's that simple.
That's all that matters.
I mean, I wasn't thrilled with McCain. I wasn't really thrilled with Romney. But I was a delegate to the convention for Romney, and I was happy to vote for him.
It is what
I'll
it
do
is.
It again.
Strategic voting is part of the plan here.
Right. And I know some people say it's the lesser of two evils, and that's the system. And then we have to do a better job of putting up better nominees. But in this case, What's fun about this case is it's finally the Democrats' problem. Because we've had to deal with this for years.
Yep.
Now they're having the problem. And I'm hoping, and for the listeners, I know Andrew is on the phone right now trying to get him. We had him back. I will reach out to Tony and try and rebook him if we can't get him on tonight. I will get him back and hopefully have him back next week. But one of the things I want to ask is the DNC has, they've got a whole war room now set up just to deal with Robert Kennedy Jr. They seriously consider him a threat. And the problem is the margins are so narrow this time. Biden is losing the African-American vote. He's losing the millennials because he wasn't able to deliver their student loan forgiveness like he promised. He's losing them because he's supporting Israel. Oh, perish the thought. And so he's losing his base. And now you factor in the fact that he's got Marianne Williamson, who's a crackpot, but she'll take a percent or two.
Right.
And, the professor, what's his name? The guy with the funky hair. Cornel West. Wow. He's running, but he'll take a percent or two. Hmm. And if Kennedy can get 5-7% of the vote.
That's huge.
Especially all that's coming from Joe. None of that's coming from Trump. Those are all Joe votes, and Joe can't afford to give up 7-10%.
Well, I know I've seen some recent polling that shows that basically, if the election was today,
Trump
would win.
Yeah, and when now you're seeing Joe Biden have to make reinforcement, pump up the troops trips to New York and California. He should not have to be campaigning in Michigan. He should not have the fact that Donald Trump is at play in Michigan, in New York, in places like that. That's not good for Joe Biden.
Right now with the trials that are ongoing, actually, in a sense, this makes the point, does it not? I think people are seeing that the government is basically been weaponized at this point.
Yeah,
they see it.
And that's you'll talk with Hans von Spakovsky.
Sure.
It's Spakovsky, by the way.
Spakovsky. I'll get that right, hopefully.
Yes. I've had Hans on the show before. He's great, but he is a true legal expert. He doesn't politicize. He just gives you the facts, just the facts, ma'am. But he will give you the straight skinny. But I think you're right. I think the fact that people are seeing this particular case more than any of the others, really, is so obvious. It's so egregious. It's so outlandish what they're trying to do here. And I think this one and the one down in Georgia are both pretty malarkey.
It's becoming so obvious it's actually backfiring, I think.
Yeah. Oh, clearly. Yeah. And I think it's going to fall apart like a house of cards. And I think people are seeing through it. And so I think you're right. And I think that's why, and Joe Biden also, it's obvious what he is. He's, a senile old man who really should just go off and play with the grandchildren that he recognizes. Cause remember, there's one that he won't recognize. So
that's sad.
Well, but yeah. That's,
but you're right.
Joe.
But the Democrats love the fact that they can basically push policy through him.
Of course. Well, they just push him around.
Do whatever they want. Sure.
They roll him out. Okay, Joey, you can have an ice cream. Here, go out there and make your speech and don't go off the teleprompter, which he does. But just go out there and read your speech, Joey. And then when you're done, you get an ice cream. And then at 2 o'clock, you're done for the day. That's Joe Biden for you. There's your music. You see how easy this is?
Yep.
Yeah, this is so easy. I don't know why they pay me to do this job, to be honest with you.
Title IX regulations were created to protect women and girls to provide them equal opportunities in educational spaces. President Biden's recent Title IX regulations are removing these important protections. With us now to explain how these changes will impact women's and girls' sports is Caroline Moore from Parents Defending Education. Caroline, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on.
Excellent. So I'm glad you're with us tonight. So with these regulations and changes to Title IX, does this change effectively eliminate the intended purpose of Title IX?
Yes, it really does. It extends the definition of sex to to gender identity, which basically means that the protected female spaces, whether it's in academic programming or just in restrooms or locker rooms, that's now up to gender identity. So if you identify as a female, you are more than welcome to use these spaces, which was not the case before. So as you can imagine, it threatens a lot of privacy, you know, safety, fairness, all of the above for females in K through 12 education, as well as higher ed as well.
That's a perfect segue to my next question here. So, you know, does President Joe Biden believe extending the definition of sex in Title IX to include gender identity is, quote unquote, inclusive, when in reality it excludes biological females as biological females? What do you think, Caroline?
Absolutely. No, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, he does it under this guise of inclusivity, but in reality, it rolls back the intended purpose of Title IX.
Yeah, it's exactly like the opposite, has the opposite effect on what it's there for, right? Exactly.
Yeah, but I think that, I don't know, this administration seems to have, I don't know, hijacked the English language to kind of, you know, make it fit what they want it to. And the average person, I think, listens to it and they're like, well, inclusive, that's good. But wait, what did you do? You know, I think that seems to be everyone's reaction.
Yeah, apparently the Biden administration doesn't believe there is a difference between biological males and females.
Yes, incredible. And as we all know, there are huge biological differences. And that's why, you know, when we're talking about things like spaces like restrooms and locker rooms, and especially when it comes to sports, you know, that's where fairness and safety really, you know, it can be an issue. Females, especially going through, you know, changes through puberty or in high school as they get older, I mean, these biological differences become more and more prevalent and they need to be separated.
Wow. Caroline, this is John Whitmer. I wanted to jump in and ask you a quick question. Kansas recently has passed, other states I know have passed, state laws that define biological sex as according to the gender that was assigned at birth. I know it was a big issue here because the legislature had to literally override the governor's veto in order to pass the law. So now how does that affect, you know, when you have a state law that will now be in conflict with Title IX, how is that going to impact?
You know, I think what will end up happening is there's going to be a lot of litigation. This rule, it came out, you know, two Fridays ago, and it actually is going to be published early this week, this coming week. And once that happens, I think that we will see a lot of complaints filed probably by states and also by, you know, tons of groups on the center right. But also any group that cares about free speech, I think, will file lawsuits against the Biden administration, because what they're doing is, you know, an overreach. Title IX was something that was passed by Congress. And so for the executive branch to effectively override something that Congress did is crazy. And also, I mean, like what you said, things that are going on in states, you can't really have state laws that are in conflict with what the president is now saying is the law of the land. It creates a lot of ambiguity.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. And Title IX has been fought for so many years, decades, actually. To destroy it this way is unbelievable to me. This is Jim Howell, Sedgwick County Commissioner. I'm speaking with Caroline Moore, who is the from Parents Defending Education. So my next question would be, this seems to have major implications for privacy and safety in K through 12 schools. What do you think about that, Caroline?
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. When this rule initially came out, a lot of groups like ours actually, I mean, I think there were over 300,000 comments filed with the Federal Register pushing back on this rule and saying it's bad, whether they were parents, community members, organizations. And we filed one. And our biggest concerns were privacy, safety, and fairness. I mean, those are the main issues here. And I think when you talk about privacy, I think on the left, they try to say, oh, well, they're individual bathroom stalls. Well, that's actually, I mean, that's not the case everywhere, first of all. And second of all, every person needs their own private space when they're using the restroom or when they're changing. I mean, these are when people are most vulnerable and in compromising situations. And a lot of people feel uncomfortable with how they look anyway when they're just dealing with all females, mm-hmm. let alone if there are biological males in the room. And, you know, this also will open up not only, you know, restrooms as you're thinking about it, you know, during the day, but it will also open us up for like sporting games and stuff. So if a kid is at, you know, a middle school basketball game and they go to a restroom, I mean, they could easily be in the restroom with, you know, an adult man, which is, you know, really concerning because I don't know, when I grew up, we were always taught, you know, stranger danger, and you shouldn't be hanging around with, right. you know, adults anyway. But like an adult male in a little bathroom, it's just, I mean, it's against everything, I guess, I was brought up to believe is, you know, true and honest and good about the world.
And if you don't play along, you get in trouble. Because right now, the way these regulations are being pushed out by this administration, it essentially forces us to have speech that ignores biology and forces us to use their preferred pronouns, which I think is puts the onus on us to know what they think they want to be called.
Absolutely. You know? No, I think that's one of the biggest overreaches with this this rule is the threat to First Amendment rights. It's going to require students to use preferred pronouns of students. And now, I don't know if you guys know this. I just know this because we get complaints from parents all the time that, you know, one day a student is Samuel and then the next day they're Sally. And first of all, logistically for the teachers and for other students, it's very difficult to keep up with what you are every day. But if you have deeply held beliefs, whether they're religious or, you know, just based on, you know, your moral code, you would have to buy into this and they, you know, use these preferred pronouns, even if they defy this person's biological sex. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge, it's compelling students to use these pronouns and it's compelling teachers to do so too. They're not going to be able to push back. And so it's a huge threat to free speech.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm really, really glad that you're helping us understand this and educate us on these topics. And if folks want to connect with you or want more information about your organization, they can find you, I believe, at defendinged.org. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. We have tons of resources on there for parents. We also have a tip email address that's on the website. Parents can send things in if they have, you know, confusion about policies or especially like with Title IX, what's going on in their district. A lot of these districts are just going to opt in for this, even though it's not necessarily required until August 1st, I think. And so I think there's going to be a lot of ambiguity. So definitely, your listeners are more than welcome to reach out to us, and we have a staff that's more than happy to talk to somebody over the phone or, mm-hmm. you know, direct them to resources on our page.
Well, Carol, I want to say thank you so much for joining us this evening. I really appreciate your time. We'll check out that website. In the coming weeks, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who announced a 34-count indictment against Donald Trump 1 year ago, will try to convince 12 jurors and six alternates that former president falsified documents to hide salacious information from voters and boost his electoral prospects in the 2016 presidential election. With us now to discuss the trial is Hans Spekowski. I think I did it right that fine that time. Senior legal fellow and manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for joining us this evening.
Sure. Happy to talk to you.
Well, I'm so sorry. I keep butchering your last name. You're it's hard for me for some reason. Right. I don't know why that is. But, you know, Hans, Alvin Bragg is claiming that Trump falsified his business records by concealing supposed violation in federal campaign finance law through a settlement payment. Is he right?
He's totally and completely wrong. Yeah. He's wrong on the law, and he doesn't have any authority as a local prosecutor to be prosecuting a case involving federal law. And I tell you very easily why. A settlement payment, that, you know, what they're claiming is that $130,000 paid to Stormy Daniels because of a potential claim that she could make. He's saying, Alvin Bragg, that should have been listed as a campaign-related expense. it wasn't a campaign-related expense. I know that. Why? Well, I used to serve as a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission. The FEC is the federal agency that actually enforces the federal law governing the raising and spending of money for federal campaigns. And there's no way that this was a campaign-related expense. And folks don't have to take my opinion for this. The FEC, where I used to serve, did not initiate any kind of civil enforcement action against Trump over this. And the U.S. Justice Department, which has criminal enforcement authority of that federal law, also did not initiate any kind of enforcement action. So neither of the two federal agencies who enforce this federal law think that this was a campaign-related expense.
You're exactly leading into my next question. I was just wondering, so how does Alvin Bragg have the authority to do this, to prosecute this? How is he able to do that?
Well, because he – look, this is a case where he believes that he can get a biased Manhattan jury, a place where in the last election, what was it, 95% of the people voted for Joe Biden, that he can get a biased jury to convict Donald Trump, no matter the lack of facts and the lack of the law on his side. And he's helped along by by a clearly biased judge. This judge, Judge Merchant, he shouldn't even be on the case. He should have removed himself from it because it turns out that his daughter is a Democratic political campaign consultant who, among her clients, is Kamala Harris, who's going to be part of the team opposing Donald Trump. This judge shouldn't even be on the case.
It's kind of a circus, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Hey, we're speaking
And by the way, just very quickly, the Biden administration's fingers are all over this because the main prosecutor who's now in court prosecuting this case, he's one of the assistant DAs, guess where he used to work? In the Biden Justice Department. In fact, he was the acting number three official in the Justice Department, and he took a pay cut to go to the Manhattan DA's office to prosecute this case.
Well, we're speaking with legal expert Hans von Spakovsky. I think I did it right that time, thankfully.
That time, hey, you got it perfectly.
There you go. Well, you know what? Sure appreciate you helping us understand this. It just seems unbelievable to me. It is, you can't make this stuff up. Testimony this week evolved around a so-called catch-and-kill strategy to intercept negative stories about the former president and then kill them. But Hans, isn't that fairly common? And more importantly, is it a legal practice?
It's not illegal. And in fact, it was actually, to me, kind of amusing. David Pecker was the witness, former head of the organization that, you know, owns the National Enquirer. He was the prosecution's leadoff witness. And yet, what did he say? He said he has done this for numerous celebrities, including Rahm Emanuel, right? You know, former mayor of Chicago, Arnold Schwarzenegger, none of whom were running for office, which just goes to show once again that this wasn't unusual. It wasn't a campaign-related expense. And by the way, if Stormy Daniels had had a real claim, he wouldn't have settled for $130,000. That's the nuisance value.
Wow.
Of her claim. That's just to avoid having to go to court to fight it, to avoid the embarrassment of it. But again, this guy who was supposed to be the prosecution's, you know, big witness, I think actually helped Trump.
Well, the former president is in a campaign, and 5 months from now, this election is going to be over. So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts about them forcing him to sit in this courtroom this entire time when he wants to be out there basically moving his agenda forward? Why are they forcing him to sit in this courtroom?
Well, because this is all part of the effort to wage what's called lawfare against this president. They want to look. the way to look at this is, what was the case that we got most recently from the Supreme Court? It was the effort to knock him off the ballot in numerous multiple states across the country. Fortunately, the Supreme Court came back 9-0 and said, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional. But the thing is that Democrats and liberals did not want the American people to have the opportunity to vote for him.
Right.
And that's what this case is about there. It's what the case is about down in Atlanta, Georgia. It's also what the federal case is about.
Well, considering the importance of this case and the importance of this president having very limited time right now, I'm just curious, are defendants always required to be present?
That to me is somewhat unusual. I didn't think that a defendant could be forced to be present in a courtroom, but this judge is forcing him to do that. Look, this case shouldn't even be taking place in New York City because of the bias of the jury and the jury pool there. And yet again, this judge refused a motion filed by Trump's lawyers for a change of venue. Once again, I think showing how biased this judge is in this case.
I could not agree with you more, and thank you for clarifying that truth. Well, Hans, I want to say just thank you for joining us this evening. I appreciate your legal expertise. It's nice to have someone who understands these things deeply. Help us to understand that as well. If folks want to connect with you, they can find you online at heritage.org. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Very good. And so, I'm going to see if I can say your name one more time. Hans von Spakovsky. Good job.
That
I appreciate your time tonight. Yeah.
It's better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame...
Two more.
You deserve this ice-cold reward. Modelo, the Markable Fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
All-star closer Kenley Jansen, we have a question.
What's the best podcast of all time?
Baseball isn't boring, baby.
I'm Rob Bradford, and every single day I'm sitting down with the biggest names to show you this great game is the greatest game. It's my podcast. It's my passion. It's a cause I started more than 2 years ago and is now the most prolific national daily baseball pod there is. Another fact, so jump aboard the BIB Express. Follow and listen to Baseball Isn't Boring, presented by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Last Friday, the governor went on another veto spree, and she did not stop until late Wednesday afternoon. The legislature is back in session this week, starting tomorrow, for their veto session once again. And joining us now to review the current legislative veto session is one of my great friends, House Speaker Pro Tem Blake Carpenter. Blake, thank you for joining us this evening.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm so glad to hear from you. You're obviously going to be very, very busy this week. I understand they're going to try to get a lot of things done Monday and Tuesday and hopefully maybe wrap things up. So what do you think is going to happen next couple of days?
Yeah, so our normal legislative session is going to end on Tuesday. So what a lot of folks might not realize is that the Kansas Constitution bounds us to a 90-day session in even-numbered years, and this is an even-numbered year. So our time is up, and so on Tuesday, that is the last day for our final normal session for this year. So we have Monday and Tuesday in order to override these vetoes, finish up the budget and any other legislation that's outstanding, and basically head home and work our normal jobs and basically get ready for an election year.
Let me just tell you, I was extremely happy with the Kansas House for that tax bill you guys put out. Was amazing. It did both income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes. It was really a nice package. I was really
actually thought the governor was going to at least let that go into law without our signature. I was a little bit shocked when she decided to veto that. But last week, you guys did a great job and basically shoved it back at her with 104 to 15 vote. I was really impressed. That means Democrats on your side of the rotunda have basically sent a message to the governor. This needs to pass. I'm more worried about the Senate. What do you think is going to happen over at the Senate side?
Well, it's going to be close, I think, in the Senate. So there were a few people missing the night that before the legislative veto session break. And so I think they have 26 votes right now. So what I would encourage people to do is contact your state senator and encourage them to vote to give you taxes. I mean, this tax bill it's a big tax bill. It's cutting Social Security taxes completely. It's getting rid of them and allowing people to keep all of their Social Security income instead of the state taxing it. Actually, Kansas is like one of 12 or 13 states that still tax Social Security. You're right. It does property tax. It eliminates the food sales tax early. It does a lot of great good for the state of Kansas. And initially, when this bill passed, it passed 119-0 before we sent it to the governor. Now, 15 of those Democrats that were a part of the 119 hopped off and did not want to override the governor, but we still have a very strong vote. And so now it's going to go over to the Senate. I'm hearing they have 26 votes, but they need one more. So again,
27.
Contact your state senators. Yep, and encourage them to override the veto so that we can get some people the tax relief that they desperately need, especially in this Biden economy, which just quite frankly sucks. I think everybody knows it. They feel it. And, you know, this fall, make sure that when you're voting, you vote for a different president. That's hopefully going to give us a better outlook.
So if the Senate doesn't actually override the veto, where are we? You know, the governor has said that she's going to call a special session. If that doesn't pass, they do some type of tax reform this year. What do you think is going to happen if this does not pass the Senate tomorrow?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we'll have about 24 hours then to figure it out and get something to her desk that hopefully she won't veto. So, unfortunately, what that means is a lot less tax relief for Kansans, I think, because one of the things that she says is our bill is too expensive, which is just shocking to me because the difference between her tax plan and the tax plan that we've passed is $35.7 million.
That's less than half a percent.
That's less than half a percent of our overall state budget.
Yeah, and frankly, the economy, you know, the consensus revenue estimating numbers came in very positive, actually, which she may have been had some concern earlier, but the last report was actually pretty good. So I can't think of a good reason at this point for her to actually veto this, other than the fact that she is not middle of the road. She is extreme, and I'm disappointed that she has put the state in this position, and it comes down to probably one vote in the Senate. And honestly, this election cycle coming up, if this doesn't actually pass, I think this is going to be on almost every postcard in every election cycle, or so every election race coming up is, where was your legislator on this issue of tax cuts?
You are absolutely right, especially because it passed the House chamber unanimously twice. Right. Before it went to the governor, and then there's a few people who chose to side with the governor instead of their constituents, 15 Democrats that decided to do that when it came back for the override in the House. And so I'm just hoping that, the Senate, they can get that extra vote. And you're right, I think people will remember it. And if Laura Kelly calls us back for a special session, I think we have a great tax plan right here. And I think we should continue to work towards that effort. And if she calls us back for a special session, well, the thing is we can work on a whole lot more stuff than just taxes if she does that. And you know what? I'm appreciative of the extra time, and there's some other stuff that we weren't able to get accomplished. So I'm looking forward to the other issues that we can work on if she decides to call us back.
So when the Senate brings this up for a vote, if it fails, doesn't get 27 votes, that kills the bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, it does. So yeah. we fail to override, and that bill's dead. Now, the content is still alive, so we can go back to a conference and find a new bill to try to put some of the content back in there and figure out how we want to move forward. But every time this bill fails, I don't know if you've been keeping track of the numbers, but the tax relief goes down each time. And so the problem is if this fails to override, it's going to be less tax relief for Kansans, and that's going to be extremely unfortunate.
There's a couple of folks in the Senate that think that they would say to themselves, or they say to the people, that they're very conservative, but they voted for the less conservative tax bill earlier, and now they're not so seem to be supportive of the House position. I find that to be very strange to me. Are you willing to name a couple of folks we need to put some pressure on to pass this? If you don't want to name them, that's fine. I know who they are, I'm pretty sure. But is anybody you'd like to name for us to?
I mean, here's the thing. There's senators that aren't running for re-election, and so they don't care. I mean, that's what it amounts to. I mean, they've basically have come out and have said, hey, you know what, I don't care, this isn't the right thing to do, and whatever the governor signs, then okay, but if the governor opposes it, then I mean these are Republicans we're talking about, but I mean Senator Rob Olson is a prime example. He seems very frustrated with Senate leadership, from what I can tell. I think that there's other personal politics that are at play and not necessarily the constituents at the forefront for Kansans.
Hi, Blake. John, how are you, sir?
Hey, John, I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Fine, thank you. You know, I remember a couple of colleagues, you know, were across the hall from me, a guy named John Dahl and another guy named Dennis Pyle. Those were a couple of senators. Since, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot to answer Jim's question, if, you know, legislators or rather if my audience is interested in reaching out to any of, you know, the senators that might be on the fence on something like this, well, I would say John Dahl would be somebody to call. I would say Dennis Pyle would be somebody to call. In fact, if you wanted to call Dennis Pyle, his cell phone number is 785-742-3780.
Good
Feel
one.
Free to give Dennis Pyle a phone call.
And actually, one of the people that we do need to give a call to, and they're actually he's at a great risk of losing his next election, is Senator Jeff Pittman, who is a Democrat that's in a Trump district. And so he's up in the Leavenworth area. So I would highly encourage everybody to encourage him to, you know, or if you know anybody up in Northeast Kansas or Leavenworth, give him a call and have them encourage, you know, the lone Democrat that might actually help get this passed.
I'll just to make this important. I've done the math for myself. This is hundreds and hundreds of dollars for me and my wife this next year. If this passes, just for someone like me, this is hundreds and hundreds of dollars of tax difference for.
But I thought this only affected the rich.
Trust me,
this is not a. Laura Kelly loves spinning this that it's only tax cuts for the wealthy and whatnot. The high tax bracket, Blake, as I recall, it's what, $35,000 a year, something like that.
Well, so if you're a single filer, to be classified as rich in the state of Kansas, if you make more than $30,000, you are rich.
That's the rich that she's talking about.
Yeah, so teachers and anybody else that you can think of that that make over $30,000, you're rich in the state of Kansas.
I think that one of the biggest parts of this this proposal, this law, is deals with the issue of income tax on Social Security benefits. We've got, you know, these folks are really hurting, and we are an outlier across this country. We're an outlier. We need to be able to do what other states have done and exempt Social Security income from income taxes. I think that's one of the most important parts of this.
Well, we've heard often that people talk about our outward migration and how we're losing population. Right. It's not only the youth that are doing it, but it's also the elderly and the people who are over 65 that are getting Social Security. If I'm over that age, well, why would I stay in a state where my money doesn't go as far because it's getting taxed? And I can move to 40-some or 30-some other states, and my money will go further. So when you're on a fixed income like that, that's going to matter, and those decisions are going to be made. And so this is going to help keep people in the state of Kansas and keep retirees here so that they can spend time with their grandkids and continue to live out their golden years here.
Well, Blake, I just want to say thank you for being on the show tonight. If you can hold over to the other side of the break, we would love to continue discussion just for a few more minutes if you can. I know there's other bills we'd like to talk real quickly.
Absolutely.
Talking with Speaker Pro Tem Blake Carpenter, and we have a couple of more bills I think that are interesting. Is there anything that's on that list tomorrow or Tuesday that you'd like to raise? I have a number of bills here, but what do you think is the hottest bill tomorrow or Tuesday?
Well, there's one bill that it's a big piece of legislation, and I think it's something that we desperately need. So it's actually the Help Not Harm Act, and what this bill is, it starts off in the Senate and then it comes to the House after they pass it. But what it is it says that youth are minor children under the age of 18 are basically prevented from getting hormone blockers, transition surgeries, things that are going to permanently impact their bodies. And so, and really what it amounts to is you can do all that stuff when you're 18, when you're an adult. But when you are a minor, that is not something that we believe is in the best interest of minor children's health. So we prohibit things like tanning beds until kids are 18. We prohibit, you know, smoking, alcohol, all these things. And so it's interesting to me is that last year the legislature, unfortunately, I missed the vote because, well, not really unfortunately for me, but my second child was born, so I was not there that day. But the legislature kicked a bill to the governor, and she signed it, which was increasing the smoking age from 18 to 21 because these individuals are not smart enough or old enough to make this mature of a decision about their health. But yet we're going to allow an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old to do permanent surgeries to their bodies. That makes no sense. There's a logical fallacy there that does not make sense. And so for us, this is something that we should enact. We should protect our minor children. Once they're an adult, hey, if you want to go, you know, have various surgeries and change your body permanently, then that is your determination to do so. But otherwise, we're going to protect you.
It seems like you can't figure out what an adult is. 18 years old is not necessarily an adult for some things, but 11 years old is old enough for other things. It's crazy.
Yep, hey, I'm just, exactly.
Yeah, I'm curious. I love listening to the legislature on some of the streaming platforms, YouTube especially. Do you know when the House and Senate will take up some of these issues tomorrow or Tuesday?
Yeah, actually. So the House is going to begin our work tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and the Senate is actually going to start tomorrow at 8 a.m. So if you wanted to, you can go to the YouTube and type in Kansas Legislature around those times, and you'll be able to see the live feeds.
Very good. That's awesome. Well, I also want to say thank you for giving us an update today. I sure appreciate that.
Hey, Blake, let me ask you. I've got to ask. You know, she's got – trying to figure out Laura Kelly. Okay, I mean, we could spend hours on that particular topic. But do you have any idea what prompted her to veto the Chinese spot drone bill? I mean, I thought this one was pretty straightforward. When I saw that one, that was a head scratch. I mean, Dan and I talked last week about the police dog bill, which I thought was another stupid one for her to veto. And then she outdid herself and vetoed a bill on Chinese espionage. I don't get that.
Yeah, John, unfortunately, you're right. We could be here for a while trying to discern why decisions were made or not on some of these vetoes. Some make more sense than others for her politically, but this one doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. It was a phase out of these drones from our law enforcement and our state agencies that are DJI drones. These drones are actually being talked about right now in Washington, D.C. to outright ban them in the U.S. And the Department of Defense, the FCC, they've all weighed in on this particular drone manufacturer and said, don't do it. It's not good. We're prohibiting this for ourselves. So what makes no sense is why we would continue to support and allow for the Chinese Communist Party to basically gain an intel picture on what our emergency responses are. It just does not make any sense. And so I'm looking forward to hopefully overriding this one as well. It does start in the Senate, so they have to go first. If it fails to override there, then we won't get the opportunity to have that vote. But ultimately, this is something I think we should pass as well.
Well, Blake, wanted to say thank you again. I know if people want to connect with you online, they can find you at Carpenter for Kansas. That's forkansas.com. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Or Speaker Pro Tem Blake Carpenter on Facebook.
Well, thank you again for your time this evening. I'm going to go ahead and go to a call. And Ed, you're on with the John Whitmer Show.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I haven't heard anybody say anything about this, but I got to thinking about, well, just the last two world wars, how much oil, fuel, and all that crap was dumped in the ocean. There shouldn't be any life in the ocean, according to the environmentalist idiots. And then all the shells that were fired in the air, I don't remember anybody cleaning that oil up or cleaning the environment up. You know, the world will clean itself up. The air will clean itself up. And, the water, the ocean must have cleaned itself up. And they have a little oil spill now. They go nuts. But you realize how much oil was dumped in the ocean? The ships?
Well,
I don't
really know the answer to that question, but it's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
They sunk so many ships, and no one, didn't everybody clean it up? Now they get an oil spill that's not near that, and they go crazy. And things clean itself up.
Well, Ed, thank you for the call. I sure appreciate that.
Yeah, I wish our side would get in their faces and start saying how nuts they are.
You know, it's funny, Jim, Ed brings up a good point. When you hear all of this talk about, like, you know, Marcy was talking about Biden's plans, it is interesting how it's a crisis, and I think that's what they play on. And I think that's kind of Ed's point is, you know, all of the what was it Al Gore said, and the squad has said it before, that the polar ice caps are melting and it's doom and gloom. The sky is falling. The worlds are going to end. And it just never seems to happen. So they constantly have to push off the date or change the term. I mean, first it was global warming, and then it was, you know, it's changed. Now it's climate change because
it's amazing to me that, you know what, everything seems to work out just fine. There are cycles around the world. It's just fine. Temperatures go up, temperatures go down. We're part of nature. You know what? Sure appreciate John. Thanks for having me on this evening. I really enjoyed the show tonight.
Pleasure. You did great. You did a very good job, my friend. I appreciate you, and we'll have you on again.
I hope so. That'd be great. In the meantime, have a great week and carry on, fellow deplorables.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Left 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
All-star closer Kenley Jansen, we have a question.
What's the best podcast of all time?
Baseball isn't boring, baby.
I'm Rob Bradford, and every single day I'm sitting down with the biggest names to show you this great game is the greatest game. It's my podcast. It's my passion. It's a cause I started more than 2 years ago and is now the most prolific national daily baseball pod there is. Another fact, so jump aboard the BIB Express. Follow and listen to Baseball Isn't Boring, presented by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.